we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper. Bonnie Berman has the day off. And again, we do hope that you'll support our station, particularly the regional and local productions such as Topical Currents. Give us a call at 1-866-247-9576. Or also, you can pledge online the easy way, WLRNradio.org. Well, today we're going to have a visit with my friend and, of course, longtime Topical Currents regular contributor, the good doctor, Dr. Paul George, of course, with Miami-Dade College and History Miami, and, of course, famous for those walking, bicycle, and floating tours. And, of course, we've done, Paul, I think, about 45 of the history quizzes, which are one of the most popular segments on Topical Currents. How long have we been doing that now?
At least 10 years. Then we had Neighborhoods prior to that. We've been together for a long time on the show.
Yeah. Well, let's begin with an update today as far as historic preservation. What's the picture? What's threatened and what should be saved that's really threatened?
Well, Joe, so many noteworthy buildings and neighborhoods haven't been designated, which means they really don't have protection in case the wrecking ball comes. Big parts of Little Havana, which have mid-20s Mediterranean-style architecture, are not designated. And there are some jewels among them. For example, there's the home of the first mayor of Miami, John Riley, that's now a Russian Orthodox church on Southwest 11th Street and 14th Avenue. It's important. He was the first mayor. There's no designation. In fact, that whole block has these jewels, and at any time...
It must have been some house if it's now a church.
Yes, it was a neoclassical jewel, real big for just he and his wife, but they had grandchildren next door, so they built a big place and a big kitchen and what have you. And anybody could come by and buy the property and knock it down. That's a problem. There's areas that have already been gutted. We all know about Brickell. What a lot of people might not know is that there was a really viable residential neighborhood there that went down around South Miami Avenue, all the way west past the Metro Rail tracks, between around Coral Way and 8th Street. And it went down in the 60s and 70s, really the 70s. But it was a great neighborhood, a wood frame buildings that went back to the teens and 20s. Gone.
When I first moved here, Mayor Maurice Ferre lived on Brickell Avenue there.
That's Santa Maria, which fortunately is still up. It serves as kind of like a clubhouse for the Santa Maria condominium. That is up, and that's terrific. But so many other great estates on that side of the street went down as the high-rises went up.
And, of course, the banking, the financial district.
Right, that became a big part of Brickell.
Mm-hmm. Paul, what's your position on this business on Star Island?
We need to preserve
with the couple who want to demolish it and build their own home.
Well, they're so flagrant in their disregard for the importance of the house. Walter DeGarmo designed it. It's a 1925 house. They say it's fallen apart, and et cetera, et cetera. I hope it can be saved and eventually restored. I know they're determined to knock it down, though.
How will it be resolved? It was just in the news last week.
Right. Well, the city of Miami Beach and the Historic Preservation Board, I think, have exercised some kind of an emergency power to stave off at least a demolition tomorrow or the next day and the next day. And it would take designation and public outrage. And there's been a lot of public outrage over the proposed demolition of it in order to save it.
Now, was this celebrity couple who purchased it, were they aware of the situation when they bought it?
In terms of its condition?
Of its condition or whether it might be designated historic?
I think they were aware of both things, and they just felt like they could ramrod everything through. That was my impression on it. I happened to be lying around on a Sunday and reading on my wife's channel surf, and we got to the, whatever it's called, the Housewives of Miami, and lo and behold, here was the lady who's married to the surgeon on the Housewives show, and she talked about it as being just, you know, an abominable thing. Got to get rid of it. It's falling apart. It's dangerous. So I'm not sure what's going to happen to it, but that's a big preservation issue today, though.
How about Coconut Grove? What's the situation with the Playhouse?
The Playhouse, for the first time in about 10 years, seems like it could be saved, restored, and reopened. Sort of a co-op deal between the state, the county, and a creative group that might want to use the place. So I have really more optimism for its future today than I've had over the last many years when it's been just dormant. And it's going to take a lot of work to get it up to going and restored.
And how about the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas house?
That's a huge controversy, Joe. There's a group that wants to keep it on its site because you remove something from a building when you take it from its original site. Another group that wants to put it over Fairchild to sort of maintain it better and to have some attention paid to it. The neighbors don't necessarily like the idea, perhaps, of it being on its site and becoming an historic building with people visiting and maybe groups using it because of traffic. And it's a very tranquil, beautiful street as it is.
I was in that house a couple of times.
Oh, yeah. It's something. And the street itself is so nice. So there's several different groups that are weighing in on this, and I don't think its status has been resolved at all at this point.
And what would it be up to the city commission?
Well, again, that whole designation process, coconut grows within the city of Miami. If they designate it, it probably could go to the commission also. I've recently been part of a group that has been able to secure designation for St. Jude Melkai Catholic Church, and that has been a tumultuous situation where the congregation didn't want it designated, and yet I should say the leadership didn't, the clerical leadership didn't, but much of the congregation did, and it's apparently has been designated, and is a real struggle. Or we can look at the Herald Building, just coming over here today at Metro Mover and seeing how the entrance now is beginning to come down. So these struggles continue. I think a lot of these things...
Do you think the loss of the Herald Building is a historic loss? I mean, that was built in the late 50s.
Yeah, they broke ground for it in 60. It opened in 63. I think it's an historic loss, but not an architectural building loss. I've never liked it in terms of its design and the fact that it took over nearly two blocks of waterfront. Historically, it's been very important, the building. And, of course, that's something that goes into considering designation, is what's its historical importance. You know, it's a case that's been resolved already, but for a wide segment of the community, it's quite a loss. It was a very difficult situation.
Now, they started constructing that in 1960. What was that area before that?
It's a great area. You had restaurants, nightclubs. As the story goes, there was gambling in the back room of some of those clubs.
No.
Yeah, it's shocking. You know, there's no visitors that would want something like that, would they? It was a really neat area at that point. And then the building went up. The Herald began to secretly buy all those properties after World War II. They made the announcement at the end of the 50s, we're going to build this huge new plant, and we want it on the water so we can barge in these rolls of paper. Obviously, today with technology the way it is, you don't do that anymore. And then they sort of took it over.
And what's the story on Bicentennial Park right now?
I just, again, taking the Metro Mover by, the construction's moving very quickly now on both buildings, the Science Museum and the Art Museum.
Museum Park, yeah.
Museum Park. And it's, you know, we hate to lose parkland, hate to lose waterfront land, but that park has been a disaster from the moment it opened. It was dedicated on the Bicentennial, and it officially opened in January 77, been a disaster. No parking. Nobody essentially was living downtown at the time. The perception and reality of crime were huge. Crossing the boulevard to get there was a problem. It's just been an absolute disaster. And it's a shame because the view from the water's edge of looking straight out at the deep water channel is stunning. So it's going to be energized, obviously, with those big museums there. And, you know, I'm kind of looking forward to it.
Have you seen plans of what this Genting structure will be?
Well, it's been a work in progress. It's changed a couple times, I believe. I saw the architectonical
plan. I guess
plan.
It depends if they can get gambling through.
Right, and that's the big thing. It's going to be a more muted thing if they don't get gambling through, the kind of gambling they want. The plans were absolutely stunning.
They want Baccarat and all that jazz.
Yeah, all kind of fancy schmancy stuff. But it would open up part of the waterfront, and the plans were fantastic. Again, it's the issue of gambling.
And that hasn't gone very well historically in the state.
It hasn't. It hasn't.
Except, it would probably be similar to the pari-mutuel situation where every county would share in the proceeds equally.
Probably
all
so.
All 67 counties.
Probably
That's the only way they can get the votes
right
in the legislature.
There's some tiny counties out there that are really going to benefit if it happens.
I've been in a few of them. Well, we certainly want to continue our conversation with Dr. Paul George, historian extraordinaire. But we're going to take a break here and be back with more.
It's Saturday morning, get up and stop yawning, take a walk with Dr. George. Be categorically correct, historically walk with Dr. George. It's history with a flair, yet so aware that he was there.
Hey, Paul, is this going to go to your head?
Sounds good.
Take a walk with Dr. George, oh come on. take a walk with Dr. George. It's only history. It's not a mystery. Oh, come on. Take a walk with Dr. George. When the Spanish came sailing in with all the sailing men, what do you think they found? There was a guy on the shore, he was giving a tour, showing the Tequesta around. He said, we're about to start. Would you senores like to take part? Oh, come on. Take a walk with Dr. George. Oh, come on. Take a walk with Dr. George. It's only history. It's not a mystery. Oh, come on. Take a walk with Dr. George.
And indeed, taking a walk with Dr. George. What a pleasure that is. That song composed and sung by Grant Livingston, a great folk artist who resides here in South Florida. Tell us about, where did you get the idea for your walking tours and boat tours and bicycle tours? And...
Joe, just having an outgoing personality and being kind of clownish, I guess, was one of the things.
I didn't know you had an outgoing personality.
I was running a program in the late 70s while I was still at Florida State in Washington, D.C., on Capitol Hill, and we would move students between buildings, and I would try to point out historical elements of the area we were in, and I think that was probably the beginning of it, and came back to Miami in the 80s and was teaching the University of Miami Florida history in Miami, South Florida. It just seemed logical that tours should accompany that, you know, as a part of the course. So I started doing that and opened it to the public in the second half of the 80s, and it's gone crazy.
Now, you're a born and raised Miami, and I think, what, you grew up in the Shenandoah area?
I did. Absolutely, and still live there, in fact.
And you went to school?
St. Peter and Paul, Curly High.
Are you the one that started the Turkey Day football
Yes,
thing?
In fact, I think you've been over for one of those events.
Yeah, I think so. It's been a few years.
It has been a while. Got to come back.
And you did your graduate work at FSU?
I did.
And your undergraduate at UM?
Miami-Dade for 2 years, and University of Miami for 2 years.
And you taught at University of Miami?
I did. I came back in the 80s and taught there.
And, of course, you teach at Miami-Dade College now.
I do. I've been there for my 23rd year now.
Now, here's a quandary that we're in here, Paul. Your graduate classes were at FSU. You have two sons at FSU. You're born and raised Miamian. You went to the University of Miami. Now, the big game is going to come up.
That's right.
Now, where do you sit?
I sit on the FSU side.
Oh. You do.
But listen, I root for the Cardinals when they play in the World Series. So I just want to make sure that's clear.
He's just referring because I'm from St. Louis.
Absolutely, yeah.
A diehard Cardinals
yeah,
fan.
Oh, yes.
Tell me, what's the most common historical misconception about South Florida, Paul?
I think the most common is, and it's something of the last 50 years, is that there wasn't really a history in greater Miami. At least some people believe this. And I've seen it in print, too, prior to 1959, which really marks the beginning of a very large Cuban influx. And the Cubans have radically transformed the area, I think, much for the better. But there was a very significant history here prior to 59. In fact, the county reached 1 million people in 1962. So they had a lot of people living here. They had to be doing something, which is what we call history. So I think that's a huge myth about it. And it tends to be perpetuated. I sometimes hear that. And I'm not a very confrontational person. Usually I just say to myself, hey, you've got to take a class or something with me.
Let's go back even farther. Many of our listeners might be new to the area. Tell them the significance of the Miami Circle.
The Circle's fascinating. The significance it is that we had people living on both banks of the river, probably at least as far back as 3,000 years ago. The Circle's been test dated back at somewhere between 2,000 and 2,400 years. And what it indicates to us is that these native Miamians called Tequestas by the Spanish and
is
others.
Is it Tequesta or Tequesta?
Probably Tequesta. I think I take kind of that hard pronunciation, Tequesta. Probably Tequesta. And they were non-agricultural people, but they had a very sophisticated kind of way of living because if you look at the Circle, and unfortunately it's covered You can see where it's perfectly circular, this cut in the bedrock, 2 to 3 feet below the surface. Post holes are there. They've got a shark's vertebrae embedded in it. It's positioned in a way where it catches the confluence of the river and bay. We found a lot of trade items around it that indicate that trade between these folks and other folks might have been as far away as beyond Florida and today's Georgia.
Some of
South
the tools,
Carolina.
But the rock that they were made of weren't native to this area. Is that
right?
Is that it?
Right, right. Some stuff might be coming from as far north as South Carolina. So it's fascinating. The significance is it tells us that these people technologically, even though they didn't farm, were fairly advanced and had a pretty vibrant lifestyle and I think trade that went on.
And I suppose most of their eating came from the bay then.
It did. The bay was their eating area, as well as a place called the Indian Hunting Grounds around the Charles Darling Estate today, way down in Deep South Dade, or anywhere, because the area had boar, it had deer, it had wild turkey, and it had a lot of fish. And that's what these people lived. It had fruits, and that's what these people lived on.
Tell me more about the Florida panther.
The Florida panther today was near extinction in recent times, and now it's being bred with a similar kind of animal out of Texas. So if you see any young Florida panthers today, they're probably hybrids. But the Florida panther almost became extinct in recent decades. And, of course, there's been a statewide effort to preserve and conserve.
And before the settlement, I understand that the panther's habitat really was the coastal ridge. It really didn't get into the Everglades until people forced them into that.
Right.
So they lost that habitat.
And it certainly was. And we have a wonderful anecdotal story. There was a lady who was, along with her husband, who was a minister and two children in 1892, living on the south bank of the river near the mouth, near the Tequesta Circle. And a very long story short, decades later, she contacted the Miami Herald. She was now 97. This is 1968. And there were conversation ensued. And so the Herald's Nixon Smiley, who was a tremendous writer,
oh, yeah,
he said, what was it like in the Miami River in 1892 when nobody lived here? Just Julia Tuttle on the north bank and the Brickles in the south. She said, well, there were alligators bellowing on the banks in front of our place. She lived in a woodsy area, Brickle Avenue around 5th Street today, and there were Florida panthers in the backyard. So I think they were indeed coastal kinds of animals. We also have stories of somebody taking that trail between Coconut Grove, which would be today's South Bay Shore Drive and South Miami Avenue, over to Brickle, and there were Florida panthers in the woods as they came across that trail. So, yes, indeed, they were close to the water areas.
I remember, must have been about 1976, as I interviewed Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, and she said she could remember when what's now US 1 was a dirt road between Coconut Grove and Miami.
Isn't that something? And it was. It followed the outlines of the Florida East Coast Railway as it crossed the river and went south.
What was most important to Miami's development, the FEC or the Miami River?
The FEC. The river had been around for thousands of years, and it was really Miami's lifeline. But once Flagler moved that railroad in April of 1896, suddenly you went from 9 people living on the river in 1895 to a city incorporated by July of 1896. It was the railroad that opened it up.
So would you say that Henry Flagler was the most dominant figure in South Florida history?
I would. And probably in Florida history, certainly in the 19th century.
Who would be second?
Oh, boy, that's a hard
one. Let's take South Florida.
South Florida. Now, clearly, Julia Tuttle, even though she lived and died not long enough, was very important for her enthusiasm in bringing Flagler into this picture. The Brickles were very important for what they did on the South Bank. The Peacocks in Coconut Grove were very important. As you move up to the New River in Fort Lauderdale, the Stranahans were very important. Meisner and Palm Beach and Boca Raton, but Flagler really lords over everybody, I think.
Maybe this is sacrilegious, but how about Fidel Castro?
You know, it's interesting. I went on a TV show about a dozen years ago, and I had a list of 10 most important South Floridians, and he was ranked number one because of his impact.
We're talking about South Florida history with the historian, Dr. Paul George. We're going to come back and talk some more. First, a break. And we certainly do appreciate your support. those who listen to public radio, WLRN. Give us a call, 1-866-247-9576, 1-866-247-WLRN. Or you can also go online and pledge effortlessly at WLRNradio.org. Paul, we've been doing these history quizzes for many, many years, over 40 of them. What's the response you get from people after you've done one of those quizzes?
Joe, it's been marvelous. I'll run into people in the immediate aftermath and say, hey, we really enjoyed it. And, you know, I think I had an answer to that question, but I was driving. I just couldn't quite get to my phone. But then months later, somebody come up and say, you know, I've heard you on a topical occurrence history quiz, and that will be maybe 3 months after I was last on. And, you know, I really enjoyed the show. And I've had so many people take my tours or take my classes because they've heard the show and have really enjoyed it. They just love the idea of it. And it's interesting because we live in this high-tech world where you can almost call up the answers now on these so-called smartphones instantly, but it doesn't matter. It's like an old-fashioned type of a show in a sense. And I think people are honest enough where they really haven't used these smartphones that much, judging by some of the answers anyway.
I'm not so sure about that. We always have one question that seems very easy that winds up being a stumper.
Right, where 10 people will call in and miss it, and we try to give them a soft landing, like, thank you so much, but that's not quite the right answer. That happens a lot, yeah.
I know during that hour, we'll take 35 or 40 phone calls.
We will.
And it really moves along.
Now, I remember seeing the switchboard sometimes, and it was just filled. It's been a great
12
show.
Calls there. And,
yeah.
And then we have people on there who don't get the question right. They want to ask a question.
Yes.
And I have to say no.
Yeah, I know.
I have to be the bad guy.
Absolutely. I'm always a good cop in this scenario.
Yeah. Tell us more about the real Julia Tuttle. Some people think she's just a causeway.
Yeah. Well, we've got a statue now, too, thank God. She was, without her knowing it, she was a larger-than-life figure, you know, moving from Cleveland as a widow with her children here in 1891 after first visiting here in 1875 because her parents, who were, you know, into moving into old age, were homesteading out in today's Miami Shores. And she came down as a young mom and visited them. And even though I'm sure she enjoyed being out there, it was called Biscayne then, she really loved the mouth of the river. That's where essentially the built environment was in the area then. And somewhere along the way, she decided to move down. She bought the property in 1887. We're not sure for how much, not a lot, and moved down in 1891 and was a person in a hurry. She wanted to carve a city. She saw this area as having all the elements of a great city, location, water, sky, weather, but there was nobody here. And she realized early on we had to link this up with the train. And once she convinced Flagler in 1895 to bring the train down, then we see the city. And then she was in a frenzy to develop the land that she still held on to. She gave Flagler about half of her 640 acres. And she borrowed money from him to do it and got in debt. And then, unfortunately, she became ill. I've seen her probate file. She was quite ill by 1898, had a nurse coming down from West Palm Beach on a regular basis by train. And as the story goes, she was going to visit a doctor in North Carolina who dealt with people with severe migraine headaches. That's what she had. But I don't think it ever came to fruition. She died in early September of 1898, and the city was astounded. They had no idea that she was this bad off. I've talked to people in my class in Miami, South Florida history, physicians, and they said it sounds like it was either an aneurysm or brain cancer. Hmm. And she was barely 50 years of age when she passed.
I suppose she's probably the only female founder of a major American city.
Certainly the first and maybe the only. And we do have her buried front and center in the Miami City Cemetery, which is really great. That's another important monument to her. But she was remarkable. And Joe, when the city was smaller and closer to its pioneer roots, we really observed the city's birthday in a big way, July 28th every year. And her son, Harry, lived into the 1940s. And he became the centerpiece as an older man by the late 30s, 40s for that birthday celebration. And there was an historical marker about where the Hyatt Regency is today that talked about that as the home of Julia Tuttle. That's where her home was and the birthplace of modern Miami. And it was really something. You know, Miami's so young that 50 years ago, you had direct links to the pioneers, or maybe 60 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We got to bring her back in a big way, and that statue really helped. And
now, what about this this business of these skulls and bones that were in the downtown area, and they were It was an Indian burial mound,
right,
I suppose.
Right, it certainly was.
And what happened with those remains?
Well, it was right on Water's Edge, and Water's Edge then would be about where the courtyard is, or maybe a little east of that, of the Wachovia Tower. In fact, they're digging just south of there archaeologically right now. They found a couple more circles, smaller circles, and they're going to build a movieplex there. And that really represents, right behind Met 1 was Water's Edge. And so the Indian burial mound was on Water's Edge. When it came to building the Royal Palm Hotel in March of 1896,
Flagler's Hotel,
they leveled the mound. And we have a description by John Sewell in his memoirs. They found about 60.
And he was a mayor.
Well, John Sewell later became mayor, but he was the foreman for that construction project. And he talked about finding about 60 skulls, and he said they're now buried under somebody's fine house. Bob Carr, based on some notations he's seen in a book that Sewell allegedly made, and Bob being an archaeologist, believes that they're buried today under a building where there was a house of a mayor before. It would be on Southeast 2nd Avenue and 2nd Street around the northwest side, which there's now a big building there that hosts a bank and offices, a building designed and built in 1967 by Morris Lapidus, of all people.
Of course, the designer of the Fontainebleau.
Hotel, the Eden Rock Hotel, many Rock, other things, yeah. Lincoln Road Mall. And Bob believes that they were put in canisters, carted away, and they're buried there. Well, it's under this building. I don't know when you're ever going to get to it, at least not in our lifetimes. But it could be there, which would be diagonally across the street from the entrance to the Royal Palm Hotel. They moved, in other words, equivalent of a couple blocks in a northwesterly direction.
Now, many people probably aren't aware that in the early Miami, the city really centered on the bay and not the ocean. That's where people built the beautiful homes and the boats were all, it was on the bay.
It centered on the bay as well as on the river, but especially the bay when it came to those beautiful residential neighborhoods. And that was really the place to be. The area where the Omni is today, from there north, which was outside of the original city limits, had splendid homes that were still standing as late as the 70s. All went down, completely wiped out a neighborhood. From the boulevard of the bay, roughly from the northern edge of the Omni all the way up to close to 36th Street. Gone. But you're right, some of the best homes are there. It was known generically as Edgewater. And today, of course, it's being redeveloped very rapidly, but so much of the great homes went down.
What's the most significant architectural edifice in Broward or Fort Lauderdale?
Strand Ann House. And it's also the most historical building in Broward County and one of the oldest, built between 1901 and 1906. Did it take a great designer? No. Probably designed by Frank Stranahan himself with his wife Ivy's help. But it's Florida Pioneer design. It's Dade County pine. That was all part of Dade County at the time. And it's a wonderful museum. It's been preserved. And it overlooks the New River.
Now, we only have a minute or so, but tell us about the demise of Frank Stranahan.
Well, Frank Stranahan became clinically depressed because he not only lost so much with the collapse of the boom in 26 and the ensuing economic problems, but a lot of his friends were kind of rooted into investments that he directed him into and in his bank. And he left the hospital, came home, and one day he tied some steel grates around his legs, put the other part in a wheelbarrow, pushed himself into the New River and drowned, 1929. And as long as Ivy was alive, she didn't die till 71, the suicide was never discussed. It was just that he died in 1929.
Well, on that note, I guess.
Not a pleasant note to end this
on. We can take a break, and we certainly hope that you'll support regional and local programming on WLRN, such as Topical Currents. And we will be having a history quiz. Paul and I really have a good time doing that, along with Bonnie and Richard on the phones and Caroline running our console. We have a terrific crew here on Topical Currents. We don't give them enough recognition. So we'll take a break and be back with more. And thanks for listening this hour. Thanks for calling in. And most especially, thanks for making pledges. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction from Michael Stock. Paul Leary is online producer. Again, our pledge line, 1-866-247-9576, or the easy way, wlrnradio.org. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, wlrn.org. To the calendar. On this day in 1896, 117 years ago, the birth of author F. Scott Fitzgerald in St. Paul. His first novel was This Side of Paradise. And on this day in 1957, 56 years ago, the Brooklyn Dodgers play their last game at cherished Ebbets Field, besting the Pirates 2-0. 55 Sullivan Place, Flatbush. The right field foul pole was only 301 feet from home plate. The Bums moved to L.A. in 1958. One more while the clock goes tick, 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 tick. On this day in 1968, 45 years ago, the first CBS 60 Minutes program airs on a Tuesday night with hosts Mike Wallace and Harry Reasoner. 1-866-247-9576. Of 60 Minutes, the late Andy Rooney didn't come on aboard until 1979. Pledge online, WLRNradio.org. So we leave with this from Andy Rooney, who died in 2011. Quote, "I didn't get old on purpose. It just happened. If you're lucky, it could happen to you." This is Joseph Cooper for Bonnie Berman. Next hour, it's Here and Now from NPR News.